dark. I could see in the dark, where they would be blind, unless they too could use echolocation, which they couldn't, or they would have used it already. Eyes still closed, I turned my head away from the opening and clicked a few times. Sonic waves showed the form of my tomb up to a point. It ran deep before fading. To a dead end? Could be. But I doubted it, because now at rest I could feel a hint of air flowing over my skin from that direction. Of course, this much air movement might come from a 2-inch gap in the wall. That the air was flowing toward the horsemen meant they wouldn't have any success smoking me out. Didn't matter. I was still trapped. I grasped for ideas. Two options came to me. I could wait here, hoping they would tire of waiting for me to emerge, or I could venture deeper in to find that source of air, hoping it was large enough to crawl through. Neither felt very hopeful. But then a third course opened in my mind. They already knew I was here, right? Why not talk to them? The thought terrified me, but by talking to them I might learn more of my predicament. If nothing else, why they were chasing me. A blazing torch filled the gap to my right. The warrior drew it back and forth, searching for me. I could see his eyes in the light, gray, like his skin. In every other respect, he looked like any other human. I was evidently too far in for him to see. He withdrew the torch and started to stand. "Hey," I said. He bent down, looked inside again, then started to stand again. "Hey!" He jerked his head back down.
"I can hear her."
"I need to talk to your leader," I said, aware that my voice was shaking.
"She's talking to me," the man said. "You can see her?"
"No." He lifted his head and twisted back.
"But she says she wants to talk to Jacob."
"To me? She knows my name?"
"No. She said leader."
"She wants to talk to the leader, then?"
"Yes, that's what she said."
They went silent for a moment before the one I now knew to be Jacob spoke.
"And what did you tell her?"
"I didn't tell her anything."
"Why not?"
"Because she said she wanted to speak to the leader."
"Now you take orders from a runaway slave, Mako?"
"She's not a slave, sire. She's one of the Bale's lab rats."
"That's hardly the point. She's an albino. I, Jacob, son of Kurong, don't speak to albinos. I will do my father's bidding, return this piece of meat to its proper place, and get back to the arms of the women who wait for me."
Someone farther away chuckled.
"And how many women would that be?" "More than you've had, Ryson. Meaning at least one."
A soft chorus of laughter. They were clearly unconcerned about me escaping. "Hey!" I yelled. That shut them up. "Jacob, aren't you man enough to speak to a woman? Or do albinos frighten you?" A long pause.
"Tell her of course not," Jacob said.
Mako bent down and spoke loudly into the crack.
"He says of course not."
"I know what he said. I can hear him."
"She says she can hear you,"
Mako told Jacob, turning back.
"Ask him how I ended up in the desert," I pressed. "Why I can't remember."
"She says she doesn't remember how she escaped."
"Of course she can't remember. Bale has cleansed her mind with his poison. Tell her that if she would just come out, we could all get back to our lives."
"She can hear you, sire. I don't think I need to just tell her."
So Mako did tell me. Some might think Jacob was dense, but I knew by his intonation that he was manipulating in his own way. His voice didn't carry cruelty. "Remind Jacob that Bale will have his head on a platter if anything happens to me," I said loudly, so Jacob could hear. My claim was pure fabrication, but I had nothing to lose. Remind him that I am the 49th. Tell him that.
Mako started to relay my words, but Jacob cut him off.
Bale said nothing of that.
Perhaps Bale doesn't know.
Perhaps she lies.
I'm not lying, I cried. I am the 49th. For a long moment, no one spoke. The 49th clearly meant something to them.
Does she think tales of prophecies will save her?
Tell her,
I'll bring the lion to lie down with the lamb, I said, remembering Justin's words and desperate for some advantage. If it wasn't true, Justin wouldn't have said so.
Another long pause.
Tell her that no harm will come to her if she comes out. She has my word. In either case, she's trapped.
I had to buy myself some time, at least until nightfall. I could see in the dark. They could not.
Tell her.
Mako told me. I may have run out of space, I returned, but I'm in too deep for you to smoke or dig out. Even if you did try to smoke me out, I might die from the smoke. So actually, I'm in charge of my surrender, not you. And I swear I'll lie here and starve to death before I come out without certain assurances.
He considered this.
Ask her what assurances, Jacob said.
Mako waited for me to answer directly this time, clearly tired of Jacob's games. But I didn't answer, not right away, because the faint sound of hissing had diverted my attention. A snake. I despised snakes, but it wasn't close. I turned my head back to the gap. The first assurance is that I will ride with Jacob on his horse. Someone out there, several someones, thought that was funny.
At least she's a woman. An albino, another said, then spat in disgust. Please, Brock, don't tell me you've never...
Silence, Jacob snapped.
To Mako, ask her what else.
I want some water in here,
I answered, without subjecting Mako to his absurd role.
Tell her she won't need water in there because I'm going to grant her wish. She can come out now.
Not now. I need to think about what other assurances I need. I need rest and water so I can clear my mind.
Tell her no amount of thinking will help her. Her flight is over.
It's not negotiable. If you want to return me to Bael alive, these are my terms.
Your terms are more time to think of other terms?
Jacob asked.
Yes.
Fire,
a distant voice growled.
With arrows. Stick one in her leg. That will motivate her.
Are you in command now, Ryson? Jacob said.
Tell me what happens if we wound her.
No response. Evidently, I was to be returned, unharmed. That gave me some hope.
How much time?
He finally asked, speaking directly to me for the first time.
The more time, the better. Darkness would be my only friend here. Till morning.
What? Absurd.
No, that would be your high priest for valuing me so highly. Otherwise you could just kill me and be done with it. After all, I'm just an albino woman, right?
Silence. Except for that hiss again, down past my feet. Suddenly I wasn't so eager to lie there and think.
For the record,
Jacob said, speaking in a low but adamant tone. I twisted my head to see that he'd dismounted and was now speaking into the crevasse.
I've never killed a woman, albino or otherwise, nor will I.
I could see his face, smoother than the others and covered with a gray powder or clay, which I thought might be the source of the flowery scent. We planned on camping here tonight at any rate, he said. It's a full day's ride back.
He slung in a leather pouch of water, and it landed halfway between us.
You have your night, but in the morning we go. I swear none of my men will touch you. Say yes.
That hissing was growing louder, and I began to panic. Because of my blindness, I'd never been claustrophobic, but snakes were the stuff of my nightmares.
Yes, I said, mind racing. I had to move.
And I did. I started to shift up and away from the sound. But with the first flinch of my foot, something hard and sharp struck my heel. Pain sliced up my calf, then my thigh. I have to get out now. I have to surrender to Jacob so he can save me. I've been bitten by a snake. I started to scoot toward the opening, but I had moved all of 3 feet when the snake's venom reached my mind. The world faded and then went black. Chapter 6. I could hear my breathing in and out through my nose as I took quick, shallow draws of air. I was safe, I thought. The bite hadn't killed me, just put me out for a little while. I took a deep breath and opened my eyes, expecting to see only the blackness of the cave. But it wasn't black. It was white. White, marked by tiny holes and 2 fluorescent lights. I sat halfway up and twisted my head. I was in the examination room, alone, with a blanket pulled up to my chest. But of course I was. I had fallen asleep on the table and dreamed of another world. Earth, 2,000 years in the future. I was... It struck me then, like a bowling ball to the chest. My eyes! I was seeing with my eyes... In Eden. There, on the wall, was a calendar with a brown dog catching a small blue ball in its mouth. I assumed it was a June calendar, but I couldn't read. With my fingers, yes, but not with my eyes. The letters were clear enough, but they were completely foreign to me. Further proof that I could truly see. If my mind was making this up, it would probably ascribe some meaning to the words. There on the counter was a silver tray with bandages and several drug vials. I picked up a large red syringe and recognized it by touch. Adrenaline, in the case of a sedative overdose, at my father's insistence. I'd held them before. This was the first time I'd actually seen one. Stunned, I flung the blanket aside and slid off the table. Pain ripped up my arm, and I saw I'd pulled an IV needle from my hand, leaving a small, bloody tear. At the same time, pain flashed up my leg from my heel. The snake bite. It seemed inconsequential to me now. I stood there beside the bed, staring around the room, overwhelmed with the sights, the colors, the shapes, the clarity of all that I saw. I blinked. What if this was a dream? The details of my experience spun through my mind, fixing me there on the floor for a few seconds. The white bats insisted I was only dreaming of Eden. Then Justin gave his charge to me. Find the 5 seals of truth. Then the hoard and the cave and Jacob. A dream. But how, if Justin had given me sight in that dream? Maybe my mind had finally surrendered to all of my father's you-create-your-own-reality talk. Epigenetics in the now. Dad? My voice sounded hollow in the empty room. I hurried to the door, eager to show him. All the surfaces and objects that I'd known as dark shapes now lay before me in brilliant dimension and color, far more beautiful than I could have expected. the round silver doorknob, the smooth gray cabinets, the glass door. Just like in my dreams, only here and now. I pulled up in front of that glass door and stared at my reflection. Blue jeans, black t-shirt, long black hair. So this is what a 16-year-old girl looked like. How I looked. I turned to my right and saw a mirror on the wall above the sink, almost magically framing my image. I stepped up to it, amazed. Bright blue eyes above a small nose, smooth, fair skin. I was here and I could see. My father had to know. The hall was empty when I stepped into it. I headed to the reception area, gazing at the dark green wallpaper and polished floor tiles. Everything so amazing and clean. My heel throbbed a little with each step, but the pain was already fading. "Hi, Rochelle." Sue sat behind the counter, watching the television. The president was talking. I'd never seen him, but I knew his voice well. So this was what a television looked like. And this is what Sue looked like. Plump, with tangled blonde hair, totally different than I had pictured her. "All done today? Your father left about an hour ago." She knew nothing about CRISPR. "I'm going to find him," I said. She glanced up. "You need any help?" "Have I ever needed help?" "Well, David's usually with you when you come." She couldn't tell that my eyes were working. I suppose they looked the same to her as on any other day. I was under the cover of my own self, incognito. "It's okay. I got this, Sue." I headed for the front door, grinning. "By the way, I like your green dress."
"Well, thank you, dear."
"You're welcome." I was halfway out the door when things clicked in Sue's head.
"How did you..."
The rest was lost when the door swung shut behind me. I looked at Eden for the first time. Bright green trees and manicured lawns. The buildings, the road, what might be a hawk in the blue sky. It was all new and stunning. I'd seen all these kinds of things before, in my dreams, but never here, in Eden, and never awake. The sky. The sky was the only thing that looked different. Brighter and bluer than anything I had seen or imagined. Definitely bluer than the sky in the desert world. Seeing really was like dying and going to heaven. Running wasn't something that had ever come easily to me in my waking life. It's hard to run when you're clicking and seeing only shapes. As a consequence, I had spent most of my life walking, and carefully. Now that I was able to see, my feet dared me to run, and I couldn't resist. I bounded down the sidewalk, then turned down the street, headed for the center of town. "Woohoo!" I cried, jumping in the air and pumping my fist. I was like a superhero in this world, able to skip and jump and spin and shout at the top of my lungs if I wanted to, and I almost did. Instead, I slowed to a walk, breathing in clean, cool air. No need to rush things. I should relish each step.
"Seeing, you do not see."
The phrase from my dream that obviously wasn't just a dream filled my mind. I might not be able to see whatever I was meant to see, but I was seeing for the first time in my life, and it was intoxicating. I caught sight of my shoes and stopped on the sidewalk. My favorite white Converses. They were more tattered and stained than I'd realized. Maybe I should listen to my father and get a new pair. It took me 5 minutes to reach the center of town, walking normally, glancing over as I passed several people. They just saw me as Rochelle, the blind girl they didn't quite know how to treat. To me, on the other hand, they looked brand new. I had no clue who each of them was, because I knew people only by their voices, and no one was talking. But I didn't want to stare and give myself away, not before my father knew. I walked down Third Street and past the grocery store, which was busy enough. Two cars and three pickup trucks were parked out front. I was tempted to walk in and see what all the groceries looked like, but decided I had my whole life to discover those things. "Hi, Rochelle." The voice belonged to Cindy Jarvis, who had just come out of Bill's Hardware to my left. "You okay?" I stopped and turned to her, unable to hide my smile. "Yes." "My, aren't we chipper today?" The woman was prettier than I'd imagined, which might be why Bill Baxter, the owner of the hardware store, had a thing for her in secret, judging by the way he talked when she was around. "It's a beautiful day," I said. And then, without thinking, "I've never seen such a blue sky." She took a puff on one of those electronic vaporizers and glanced up. "It is a nice day." She paused, eyes back down, studying me. "That's right," I thought. "I can see. I can see everything you can see. And seeing you, I can see why your boss has a thing for you. Yep, that's something I've already seen. So, see, I can see even better than you." The door opened, and a boy my age stepped out. "You can see the sky?" Cindy asked. But my eyes were on the boy. I didn't know who he was yet, but I could see how he looked. A foot taller than me, with wavy brown hair and blue eyes like mine, which looked amazing with his dark hair. Even more amazing with the blue shirt he was wearing, sleeves rolled up around strong muscles. A part of me that didn't know any better fell in love with him at first sight. I was, after all, still a 16-year-old girl, and although boys had never really been a part of my life, I could see now why they should be. He stared at me for a few seconds. "Who can see the sky?" he said. "Peter." This was Peter Moses, the son of Simon, the judge. The same Peter who had never given me a second look that I knew of, the boy I had sometimes imagined being kissed by. That was in my dreams. In real life, I didn't dare talk to him. I could feel fear pulling me under like sinking sand as I stared at him, and the thought of falling back into fear terrified me more than the fear of talking to him. So I impulsively stepped up to him, searched his face and eyes, and said, "The sky's as blue as your eyes, Peter Moses." I reached up and touched his cheek. "I never realized that you were so pretty." He blinked, but stood perfectly still. "Rochelle?" a voice yelled. I spun to the sound of my father's voice. He was running down the street past the church. "Don't touch her," he yelled. To me, "What are you doing? How did—" I ran to meet him, feeling like a goddess treading among mortals, and to me he looked like a god, beautiful and strong. "I can see." Then I was in his arms, being swung around. He held me tight for just a moment, then set me down and held me at arm's length, staring at my eyes.
"What do you mean you can see?"
"I can see." I swept my arms wide, looking at the tall trees by the church and the blue sky with fluffy clouds up high. "Everything. I can see everything." At least a dozen people within earshot of my announcement stopped what they were doing and looked at us. R.G. and Miranda were running down the street from the direction of the hospital. I was suddenly the center of attention. My life had just been made new.
"But honey, CRISPR doesn't work like that,"
my father said, still stunned.
You blacked out. We thought you were in a coma."
He remembered where he was and glanced around.
"She can really see?"
Cindy asked behind me. A circle of sorts was forming around us. What's CRISPR?
Miranda and RG burst through the gathering crowd.
It wasn't CRISPR, I said to my father. I was healed in a dream. A man...
I stopped, realizing how absurd it would sound.
What dream?
Cindy asked.
You can really see, Rochelle? Like normal?
I don't know what normal is, I said. But I'm looking at the flowers on your shirt, and they're green. Pretty flowers. She glanced down as if to confirm what she obviously knew.
What man?
Bill Baxter had joined us on the street and was looking me over.
Vlad Smith,
my father said, putting his arm around me as if to protect me.
A healer who visited the hospital today.
He began to shepherd me away from them.
Please, give us some room.
With that, he hurried me away, followed closely by RG and Miranda.
It's true?
Miranda asked, hurrying to catch us.
We should run some blood work.
And then, when I didn't respond,
but how's that possible? Nothing we did could have caused such radical spontaneous remission.
When we were far enough away from the small crowd, all now talking excitedly, my father turned to me, eyes misted with tears. He cupped my cheek with his hand.
You really can see?
I mean, yes, but you can see my face? My eyes?
For the first time, I smiled at him. I always knew you were handsome, but didn't realize your eyes were so blue, just like mine. I don't think he'd believed this day would ever come.
I know I hadn't. Not really.
Who's Vlad Smith? I asked.
No one, honey.
But Miranda didn't let it go.
You don't actually believe.
Of course I don't.
He glanced at the chattering crowd.
Better for them to get lost in some harmless metaphysical psychobabble than ask more questions about CRISPR.
You told them about CRISPR?
No, but I might have let the word slip.
Who's Vlad Smith?
I asked again.
Tell me.
So he quickly told me how the man had come while I was sleeping and pricked my finger before reciting something about seeing. A moment of confusion darkened my mood. There was Shadow Man.
Who was Vlad?
Shadow Man had insisted that he would blind me again, but I could see. Really, see?
He said that?
I asked. That he'd come to heal me and give Eden sight?
Something like that, yes.
What else did he say?
My father pointed me toward home.
He said that things aren't really what they seem. Like the wool's been pulled over our eyes. And he claims to know more than Simon.
Do you believe him?
I don't know. No. I doubt it.
But I can see.
So maybe he did something good, right?
He shook his head in wonder.
Yes, you can see.
Kissed my forehead.
But I can't say he had anything to do with it. I think spontaneous remission...
Spontaneous remissions don't present in 2 hours,
Miranda interrupted.
Not like this.
We don't know when it started. Could have been keyed up for months now, without our knowledge. She can see. That's what's important.
I should talk to him,
I said.
Not a chance,
my father said.
I don't want you anywhere near him.
Not until we know more.
David?
We all turned toward the church, where Simon Moses stood, staring at me.
She can see?
My father took my hand.
Come on, honey.
He led me toward the judge.
Let's show them.
There were 4 of us and 4 of them seated at the table in the council chamber. I knew them all by their voices, but was amazed by the difference between how they looked with echolocation sight and eyesight. The four of us were me, my dad, Miranda, and R.G. The other four were Eden's governing council. Simon Moses, the judge, whom I had always thought of as God's authority on earth. I had a deep respect for him. He had soft but firm eyes, which suited him well. Simon had always been kind to me, like a rock, but genuinely caring. Linda Loving, who had a genuine heart for the community's well-being, the children in particular. She kept looking at me and smiling. Maxwell Emerson, who was in charge of all resources, meaning money, food, and energy. He wore a new blue suit that was too tight across his large belly. Bald, shiny head. I'd always heard a distant, uncaring quality in his voice, and seeing him now only deepened the impression. The flesh around his eyes drooped like big teardrops. I felt a little sorry for him. Barth Caldwell, who was in charge of security. He reminded me of what I thought a bulldog looked like, or a Rottweiler. A good-looking one, who was as tall as he was thick, black hair and bushy eyebrows. He made me nervous. That was them, seated across from us with Simon at the head of the table. My father had just recounted all the details concerning the injection of CRISPR and the entrance of Vlad Smith. I should say all the details except Smith's claims that something was wrong in Eden. All four had listened with eager attention, and at times bewilderment. It isn't every day that blind people just start seeing.
"You're saying this Vlad Smith actually healed her?" Barth asked. "That this little parlor trick of his somehow opened her eyes?"
"No, I'm not saying that. I'm just filling you in on what happened. Nothing more. God doesn't heal that way."
"You don't know that," Linda said. "Jesus healed the blind using mud." He glared at my father, which surprised me. We'd come to give them the good news, but Barth looked like we'd just told him the hydroelectric plant had blown up. As I saw his reaction, fear began to creep back into my mind. Barth scooted his chair back and walked to a liquor cabinet, illegal everywhere but in here, evidently.
"The president's declared a national state of emergency. Freeways are being closed along the East Coast to keep people from clogging them up. Nothing's flying east of Denver. Salt Lake will be next. We need to shut down the road. Whoever Smith is, he's got to go before he causes any more trouble."
"Trouble?" Linda glared at him. "Have some decency. Rochelle can see, for crying out loud."
"You'll have to forgive his manners,"
Simon said, looking at me apologetically.
"Tough times."
I smiled. "It's okay." Barth lifted his glass toward me.
"I'm happy for you."
To Simon.
"But this character's a problem."
Simon acknowledged him with a slight nervous nod. He faced my father.
"Who else knows about him?"
My father shrugged.
"Everyone in the square. By tomorrow, everyone in town. You can't keep a lid on something like this."
The judge slowly leaned back, face drawn. What struck me was how upset he was, even without having heard the details my father left out. It made me wonder if the judge really was hiding something. I decided then that I didn't want to be in that room. The sooner we got out, the better.
"Where is he now?"
Simon demanded.
"I don't know. He just walked out."
"Find him."
He drilled Barth with a glare.
"Find him now."
"Shouldn't be hard."
The councilman drank the last of his liquor and set his shot glass down.
"Find him and bring him to me. Then seal up that tunnel. No one gets in without my express permission. You hear? Not a mouse."
"Why not just throw him out?"
because I want to know what he thinks he knows. Simon's eyes shifted to Linda. Call a town hall meeting for tomorrow night. I want every last soul there. The last thing we need right now is someone exerting authority based on a parlor trick.
His reaction had me thinking about my dreams again. It was something the Rausch had said about how I could know this was a dream by asking the right questions. Right there in those chambers, everything seemed real. But that's also how I'd felt when I was in the desert. What if this was the dream, and I couldn't really see? I couldn't shake that feeling. The fear of that possibility pushed me over the top. "Can I ask a question?" I said.
The judge turned his head. "Of course."
"Do you think it's possible that something's wrong with Eden?"
My voice was thin.
All eyes were on me.
A shadow crossed my dad's face, and I regretted asking the question. But it was too late now. "What do you mean, wrong?"
the judge asked. "I mean, what if we're blind and don't know it?"
They just looked at me, including R.G. and Miranda. Simon finally forced a polite grin. "What makes you ask that?"
"The man in my dreams."
"What man?"
"Actually, it was a fluffy white bat."
I held out my hand to show size.
2 feet tall. Called a Rausch.
Silence.
I felt a little foolish, but I had only asked a question. Maybe I should have left out the part about the bats.
My father came to my rescue. "Metaphorically speaking, I think we all have our blind sides, even in Eden. You know that better than most, Rochelle."
"Blindness," the judge said, "is the condition of the world, not Eden."
I nodded. "Yeah, that's what I thought." For a long moment that I thought might not end, Simon just stared at me. Then he abruptly stood and walked out.
"Meeting adjourned," Barth said, grinning. My father was looking at my arm. I glanced down and saw that, seated the way I was, my T-shirt sleeve had ridden up my arm a bit, exposing a mark on my shoulder. I reached over and pulled my sleeve all the way up. There, on my arm, was a circle about 3 inches in diameter, like the one I had in my dreams. But how was that possible?
"What is it?" Linda asked.
I touched it with my finger, then rubbed it. A tattoo. Not fresh, but old, if I wasn't mistaken. My mind spun.
"Where did you get it?"
my father wanted to know. I quickly pulled my sleeve back down.
"I'll explain later."
But I knew there was no way to explain it. That day in Eden was without question the best day of my life. On one hand, everything was topsy-turvy because a part of me, the part with a tattoo from another world, couldn't stop wondering what was really happening. What was the 49th? Was it real, like the tattoo on my arm? Was there really light in my veins? Of course not. So it all had to be in my mind. Symbolism, like my father insisted. If the 49th was real, that would mean Shadow Man was also real, right? I couldn't accept that thought. On the other hand, being able to see filled me with wonder. And once I let go of my fear that I would fall back into fear, I couldn't wipe the grin off my face. It faded a little when Miranda worried aloud that my sight might only be temporary, a psychosomatic alteration prompted by dreams so vivid that they'd convinced my mind to manifest sight. "Classic epigenetic spontaneous remission," she said. "When people believe, really believe, then genes change, and the body follows, regardless of religion, creed,
or history. But when belief wanes, conditions revert. My father scolded her. Considering my nightmares, she should know better than to voice the concern. She apologized. My grin returned when my father took a sponge, dumped some soap on it, and vigorously scrubbed the tattoo on my arm, sure that he could get it off. He couldn't. The pain in my foot was gone. I pulled off my shoe and found two small red spots on my heel, right next to a small cut from running through the desert. Real. So the dream I'd had wasn't a dream. Justin had healed my eyes, and the bite on my heel along with the tattoo on my arm proved it to me. As for Shadow Man, if he was real, well, he was only a personification of my fear. Justin, on the other hand, had healed me. I refused to believe anything less. I could see. And what I saw blew my mind. I was the fascination of the town. After Miranda, R.G., and my father had poked and prodded me and taken more of my blood to run even more tests, my father escorted me home. He didn't want me mobbed. Then he returned to the clinic. I went out twice by myself that afternoon, in part to prove to myself that I had nothing to fear, in part just to see the town. Both times I was quickly surrounded by people I knew, though not by sight, and again that grin was stuck to my face. "How many fingers am I holding up?" Randy Caldwell asked when he and four other kids hunted me down.
"That's too easy," his younger sister Ashley said. "What color is my bicycle?"
"Purple," I said, "with a white pinstripe." "How many fingers am I holding up?" Randy asked again, holding his hands behind his back now.
"One. Your thumb. The rest aren't pointed up."
He did a double take.
"You can see that?"
"No," I said. "It's how everyone holds their hands behind their backs."
Pretty Peter, the judge's son, was leaning against the church, arms crossed, watching us.
"Excuse me."
I left the group of younger kids and walked toward Peter, heart hammering in my chest. He straightened and lowered his arms as I approached.
"Hi, Rochelle."
I could smell the lavender soap he used to bathe.
"Hi."
He was shy, too, I thought.
"How did it happen?"
"Like my father said."
"Yeah, I know. A healer. But what really happened? Because whatever it was, my father isn't too pleased. They can't find him."
"They can't find the judge?"
"No, this Vlad Smith guy. He's gone."
I shrugged. "I don't know. I never did see him. To be honest, I'm not sure I gained my sight here."
"What do you mean? Not here."
His gentle blue eyes were filled with genuine curiosity.
"Just between us? Because not even you will believe me."
"Just between us."
So I told him. Everything. Even the part about Vlad Smith saying there was something wrong with Eden. I told him because I wanted to tell someone, if only to hear myself speaking it. And I had to admit, hearing myself, I wondered once again if everything in my dreams was only the product of wild imagination, mirroring my own experience here in Eden. I told him that as well.
"Then how do you explain the tattoo?" he asked.
I lifted my shirt sleeve and stared at it.
"So it must be real, right? Plus, I can see."
"Can I touch it?"
"Touch it?"
"First tattoo I've seen in real life."
"Me too."
They were illegal in Eden, thanks to a teaching that marking the body was ungodly. So was jewelry, and any clothing that revealed too much flesh. And unsanctioned courtship.
"Go ahead."
He touched my skin with one finger first, drawing it over the thin circle, then with his hand,
gentle and warm. I couldn't deny the way his touch stirred up butterflies in my belly. Our eyes met.
"Feels like normal skin," he said.
But he let his hand linger a few seconds before lowering it. My breathing had thickened a smidge. Could he hear it the same way I could?
"Yep, just normal skin."
If people saw us standing here like this, they might get the wrong idea. "I have to run, okay?"
"Okay."
His voice was strained. "Okay." I started to leave, but turned back. "Keep what I said between us, right?"
"I will."
I hurried straight home with my head down, watching the road so no one would stop me. That smile returned to my face halfway there. I did believe I'd just had my first romantic encounter. Yes, I knew from my father that such feelings were caused by a cocktail of hormones called limerence, secreted by the pituitary gland to ensure the bonding and mating of the species. The love feelings associated with limerence lasted from 6 to 24 months before fading, just long enough for humans to relax their judgment of each other, couple, and bear children to keep the race alive. Beyond that, limerence had to be cultivated in the brain through intention. It was all hormones, you see?
Sure. So was the taste of a sweet peach, and I loved it.
By the time I kissed my father goodnight, I was thoroughly exhausted. I breathed a prayer of gratefulness to God. I was obviously doing something right, because I could see.
"And when you see, I'm going to blind you. I'm going to blind you again and again."
Shadow Man's voice fell into my mind as I fell into bed, and with those words, fear darkened my world, as if the plug on my light had been pulled. I sat up in the darkness and turned on the nightlight. What if the nightmare returned? What if Shadow Man really would come and blind me again? Now that I was able to see, the thought of losing my sight filled me with a new kind of terror. I had to suppress the impulse to throw off the covers and rush to my father. But we both knew my fear was only in my head, anyway. I'd faced fear my whole life. I could do it one more night. I lay back down, intent on letting go of my fear. My experience in the desert, seeing the light being pushed from my veins until I was once more blind, gave me some comfort, because it reminded me I was only blind to who I really was. Was being blind to who you are better or worse than physical blindness? One of my favorite stories of Jesus popped into my mind. It was about a young man born blind, kind of like me. Jesus healed him. When asked whether the boy's blindness was a judgment for his father's sin or his own sin, Jesus said, "Neither." The boy was born blind so that the work of God would be seen in him. When I first heard the story in Sunday school many years ago, I could feel the rest of the class looking at me. What a cruel God, I had thought. What kind of father would subject his child to so much suffering just so the world could see God's light? I'd rushed home and read the story over and over in Braille, feeling like a victim of some cruel joke, a pawn in a war for power. But then a new thought dropped into my mind, and I gasped aloud, right there on my bed. The boy hadn't been born blind so that the world would see the work of God. He'd been born blind so that he himself would one day see God's work in him. Which meant that even though I had been blind since I was a baby, maybe my blindness would one day allow me to see God's work in me. Blindness wasn't a punishment. It was a gateway, an invitation. Right then, the story became a favorite. I set it right next to my fear that I was being punished by God, unable to reconcile the two thoughts, but finding hope anyway.
I clung to the story now as I lay in bed. More than 2 hours after climbing under the covers, I finally drifted to sleep. And when I fell asleep, I dreamed. And when I dreamed, the whole world changed.
Chapter 7.
I knew I'd fallen asleep in my bed with a nightlight on. But when I awoke a moment later, it was pitch dark, and my first thought was, "Oh no, Shadow Man was right. My blindness is back. I can't see." I jerked up in my bed and hit my forehead on something hard only inches above me. The blow knocked me back down, and my head landed on what I thought was my mattress. I quickly glanced around, clicking to see. But I didn't need the clicks to see the dim outline of the gap 20 feet to my right. I was in the desert again. Yes, I was in the desert at night, under the huge rock where I'd been bitten by a snake. I'd been dreaming of Eden. This world was my true reality. It must be. The Horde had poisoned me and stolen my memory. So I dreamed I was blind in a place called Eden. Justin had healed that blindness. So when I dreamed of Eden again, I could see. Here, in reality, I was trapped under a rock with my captors guarding against any escape. The only advantage I had was my echolocation.
"And where did you learn to echolocate, Rochelle?"
Then both worlds were real. And here, I was in terrible trouble. Justin's words whispered through my mind once again. If I was to believe him, I would bring crisis to both worlds and then show them the way to freedom. But I couldn't do that unless I resolved my own fear by finding the 5 seals of truth, discovering those seals with my personal journey so I could help others find their way out of darkness. My mind spun. One thing was clear. I hadn't resolved my fear. I could hear soft snoring from the clearing outside. As promised, Jacob and his Horde warriors had camped for the night. My leg was stiff, but the snake's poison was wearing off. A good thing. My situation was anything but good. The sun would eventually rise, and I would have no choice but to starve or surrender myself. I clicked to my left and saw into the deeper reaches of the crevasse. The gap narrowed in another 20 feet, too narrow to squeeze through. What about the other way, past my feet? But no, that was where the snakes lived. I turned my head back toward the Horde encampment. No glow from a fire. I'd rather take my chances with the warriors. At least I knew they were sleeping. Most of them, anyway. Taking a deep breath, I scooted right up to the gap itself. 2 hulks slept on their sides 10 feet from the opening, but I couldn't see beyond them. Slowly, barely breathing, I stuck my head out and clicked. The rest of the camp came into dim view. At least 30 warriors slept in rings around a fire that had long burned out. There had to be a wakeful guard stationed. But where? Maybe in the narrow passage that led from the bowl. It was too far off for me to make out that passage. I only knew that it was to the right, 15 paces or so. The sound of my pounding heart was far too loud. But it was unlikely their auditory senses were as developed as mine. Using my hands as claws, I pulled myself into the open. None of them stirred, so I rose to a crouch. Still no movement. If I could get into the narrow passage, I would be able to see what they could not. At least, that was the thought. Stepping ever so gingerly, I eased along the wall. I dared not click here for fear of being heard. But when the wall began to fall away behind me, indicating I was at the passage, I had to click, just to see if there was a guard stationed inside. Click, click. The view from my clicking showed the guard who stood 10 paces in, leaning against the wall. I heard the whinny of a horse. For a long, terrible moment, I stood frozen as at least 12 men bolted up from a dead sleep. I had to go now. I had to go now, and I had to go clicking so that I could see. Bent over in half, I bolted into the narrow passage, clicking wildly. The guard pushed off the wall, legs spread, ready to face the disturbance. He might have seen me, I don't know, but he was pulling his sword when I dived to the sand at his feet and rolled between his legs. Then I was past and on my feet and lunging headlong down that dark passage, clicking to see the walls. "Fire!" the guard roared. "Bring fire! She runs!" I ran as fast as I could, knowing my head start would give me no more than half a minute as they quickly mounted and gave pursuit, using torches to guide them. My challenge now was getting out of the labyrinth of towering rock the same way I had gotten in. Finding another hiding place would be pointless. Once the sun rose, I would have no advantage. So I ran down the first passage, then a second, hoping that my memory was serving me correctly. The first guard was on foot, following the sounds of my scrambling feet, panting. I could hear his breathing bearing down from behind and ran faster. So did he, surprising me with his quickness. I had just burst from the canyon into the open desert when he reached me from behind. Something hit me at the back of the skull like a mule's kick and sent me sprawling face down in the sand. Darkness crowded my mind as I fought to retain consciousness. A grunt cut the night, and I thought he was going to impale me. A hand grabbed the back of my tunic, plucking me from the ground. I stumbled forward a few steps before the warrior hauled me onto the back of his mount. Now, at a full gallop, I twisted and tried to free myself, but his grip was like iron.
"Do you always try to escape those who free you?"
the rider growled under his breath.
"Stay."
Only then did I consider the possibility that the warrior wasn't Horde. He certainly didn't smell like them. "Who are you?"
"Not now."
The rider veered into a shallow draw and up a slope that led to the top of the canyon cliffs. He pulled up.
"Off, quickly."
I slid off the horse, and he pulled his mount down until it rested on the ground. The stars shone brighter up here than in the canyon, and I could see that his skin was like my own. "Albino?"
"Shh! Razor,"
he whispered in his horse's ear, smoothing its neck. Then he scrambled to the edge and peered at the desert floor below. I crawled up next to him on my hands and knees. Far to our left, the horde had spilled from the canyons on horseback, circling with lit torches, searching for sign of me. At their feet, one fallen warrior.
"You killed him?"
I whispered.
"This way,"
one of them roared. They had found our tracks. My rescuer drew me back from the ledge.
"They'll follow our tracks here, but we'll lose them in the rocks."
He stuck out his hand.
"Samuel,"
he said.
"Samuel of Hunter. You can thank me later."
I took his hand, looking at a strong, youthful face in the dim light. No more than 20, I thought. By the sound of his voice, I guessed that his gall knew no bounds, and I wondered if I'd been pulled out of the frying pan and into the fire.
"Hurry!"
Chapter 8. Samuel of Hunter took the horse across the top of the canyon lands, sticking to the flat stone so as not to leave clear tracks. I sat behind him, one arm around his belly, the other gripping his leather chest plate. I was riding behind a powerful warrior with long, dark, wavy hair that whipped around my face unless I leaned in close. The scent of his skin was sweet and musky, like sweat-soaked lilacs. He rode the horse as if it were a part of his own body. The Rausch had mentioned Thomas of Hunter in the highest regard. Was Samuel related? Or maybe Hunter was a place. When I tried to ask him, he hushed me. For 20 minutes we crossed the rocky plateau above the canyons before he pulled the horse into a pass that descended to the sand. He took the mount to a full run and headed into the open desert. A gnawing wariness overrode my gratitude. Did he know who I was? Why had he saved me? Where was he taking me? Did I have anything to fear from him?